You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 13th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a special guest, Christian Hubicki. Christian, welcome to the SGU.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
This is actually in podcast time. This is your third time doing a show with us, although this is your first actual presence on the show. So this week's episode is mainly going to be a one-hour live show that we recorded with you as a guest at DragonCon. You know, they only gave us an hour, and we figured we need more than that for a full show. So you agreed to give a virtual interview with us after the facts. Now it's like a week after DragonCon. This is the week that the show is going to come out. We're just going to have a little preamble discussion before we go to the live DragonCon show. For those who don't know, you'll hear again in a bit, but Christian, you are an alum of the Survivor TV show.
That's right. That's right.
Yep. We talk a little bit about that on the show. And you are a professor of robotics at the Florida State University as well.
That's right. That's right. And I got to say, as professor, I'm not used to being cut off after an hour. The students stay until I'm done. So
that's right. You leave when I say you leave.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, it was fun. So, you know, when we got together with Christian at DragonCon, we had never met in person before. We emailed each other like a few years ago, I think, right?
That's right.
But we had like really good discussions over a couple of meals during DragonCon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, we're all super into it. You know, like, of course, we're all super fans of robotics and we like artificial intelligence and we're like really like getting into it. I'm like, damn, these conversations were really good. We should have recorded them because we asked a lot of wacky questions too, you know, because we'll like ask anything when we're not – when we're at dinner, we're like, so how, you know, what are sex robots going to be like? You know what I
mean? We can go there.
That was not recorded, thankfully. For my tenure packet, I'm glad for that. But otherwise, it was fantastic. You know, no, that was
Christian's
good stuff.
Like, I got 15 of them. They're awesome.
And don't forget, guys, don't forget, Liz and Courtney were, you know, they watch Survivor every season. And they were very psyched.
Yeah, they were big fans.
But I'd say what relevant to discuss, speaking of sex robots, Jay, then it was something that came up in casting interviews when, you know, you're interviewed before you go on the show. And so I was prepared that I was going to be interviewed by like a Hollywood casting person. And I tried to prepare myself. What are the stereotypical questions that people are going to ask you? And one of them, of course, would be about sex robots. So I had some pre-canned jokes. I didn't study sex robots in robot school. That was one of them that deployed.
It wasn't a course.
No, I didn't enroll. it was capped out. I couldn't get in. But I would though recommend the reality casting process to anyone trying to go on a job interview, because there's probably no harder job interview than whatever curveballs they try to throw you in order to see how you'll react on a reality show. So highly recommended for at least the experience.
This is our first time back to DragonCon since the before time, right? The pre-pandemic. What'd you guys think about it? You guys have a good time?
I made an observation.
Yeah.
And I talked to several people at DragonCon. I did notice that the overall quality of the costuming was not at the level that it's always been at for all the DragonCons we've been to.
Yeah. There were some standouts, but it was a little underwhelming this year.
And I thought about it, and I talked to some people at DragonCon who made similar observations, and they were saying that they noticed that this happened post-pandemic. This is a post-pandemic thing that's happening at DragonCon. And we were surmising it's probably because people are financially strapped and they don't have like the $5,000 it probably takes them to build some of these costumes, some of the more outrageous ones.
Or invest the 1,000 hours it takes to over the year to build the costume you're going to make.
Yeah. I know for us, like, because like we had, you know, some really good costume ideas percolating and we backburned them all. And then even though we went this year, we decided late. And so you didn't have as much time to invest in it because it was like up in the air. You didn't know what was going to be going on with the pandemic and everything. Yep. So yeah, but it's bouncing back. The numbers haven't completely bounced back yet to pre-pandemic levels. It's kind of
Christian,
like the world.
This was your first DragonCon. What's your take on it?
Indeed it was. I'll tell you, I was overwhelmed. I actually showed up on Thursday because I was giving a talk at Morehouse College in Atlanta for, you know, just for general robotics purposes. And I jumped over to the conference just to get my badge and everything. And I was just swept away by just the wild amount of costumes. And I had no baseline, and I got to see the big Zelda Korok protest, the Korok rights protest, which is probably the best thing I've ever seen. So I got to say, I enjoyed it. And I guess I was also sort of taking in the fact that I had to give like two full hour long talks. So I think I was overwhelmed by that as well. But I had a great time. I know me and Emily had a wonderful time hanging out with you guys and also just running around the conference, seeing what happened.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of the best costumes I saw this year were ones I've seen in previous years, and so they don't have the same impact. You know, it's like, oh yeah, there's the guy from Lord of the Rings. Yep, saw him. But for you, it's the first time. It's like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, there was a Mark Hamill, which I double take. That was really close to a Mark. Oh, that wasn't that. That was
I
crazy.
Remember. Yes,
yeah,
he was Last Jedi, Mark Hamill.
I saw him, it's a double take. Like, wait, is that really him? No, it's not him. Yeah. But like, for a half a second, you think it's him. There are some people. There's a couple of people who lean into the fact that they look like a celebrity and then dress like them. There's also every year there's an older Scotty from Star Trek walking around.
Yeah,
the movie version of Scotty who's a dead ringer. Yeah, but Mark Hamill.
That was a double take for sure too. Christian, what about you? Did you see any stars, any celebrities?
Honestly, I didn't. I missed the whole celebrity thing. I mean, the only times that I've like met like a real superstar celebrity, I remember almost nothing from the interaction. It's like they could have been speaking the Charlie Brown adult voice as far as I was concerned. I just remember the experience that I was in their presence. I said things. Hopefully they weren't overly embarrassing. And then they kicked me out of their house and we were done. So
I totally.
And then the police came. They
slammed the door. Slammed the door on me.
There is really something about charisma and that type of human interaction. Like when you're meeting someone that's famous, you know, because we've met lots of famous people throughout the years, and you realize everybody's just people, right? They're all people. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, like when I met Prince, I had the opportunity to meet Prince, and. Like, my God, wow. You know, like, that was not a normal meeting of a famous person where you're like, oh, cool, I'm seeing this famous person. Like, that guy had charisma that was, like, palpable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like, surreal, you know? Plus, he's so incredibly famous. When I met him, he was unbelievably famous, you know? So it was just very strange. So it is a pretty interesting experience. Like, there is something mammalian about it. Like, it's hardwired into us.
Yeah, I was busy doing a bunch of panels. The most surprising panel to me was the UFO panel.
UNP. Yeah, I saw that. Bob and I saw that. Well, yeah, you were there too.
I was there.
Saw
that.
You were finally convinced, Steve, right?
Well, no, it's just that I saw all the panels I was going to be doing. I'm like, really, UFOs? Isn't this like, didn't we beat this dead horse already? But it was like one of the most popular panels that I did. It's very hard to predict, like, you know, what people are going to want.
It's because of how in the news it's been.
I know. Oh my gosh, and it even among skeptics, like, they there is something a little bit different, I think, about this, what's happening now. With the UFOs. And I think because the UFO community has managed to like really snooker the government into lending them credibility, people are like, this is before Congress and this is the Pentagon. Something's got to be going on, even though it's the same crap as we've been seeing over the last 30, 40 years.
They got NASA tied into it too, Steve.
So
talk about legitimacy.
After the panel, like the next day, like somebody recognizes me on the street and wanted to talk to me about the panel. Meanwhile, I'm late for another panel that I'm going to.
You had like six panels, Steve. It's ridiculous.
But did you see this video? You know, that thing.
I'm like,
So I said, listen, I'm late for a panel. Email it to me and I'll take a look at it. I gave him the, you know, info@email and I never got it. I don't know if he didn't remember or whatever. But the one thing that really, I mean, I knew this, but like it was really central to the discussion was the fact that because we are always trying to talk about like how silly the conspiracy theories are, et cetera. But the one of the problems that we have is that the government does hide things, you know, and especially in surrounding the UFO phenomenon. Like, for example, there's a lot of UFO sightings around military bases. And it's, you know, we know from now historical records that a lot of them were, they were testing the spy plane, you know, whatever. But of course, the government's not going to come out and say, you know, explain the UFO sightings as secret military, you know, testing. And so there is a layer of secrecy that's built into the whole thing. You know what I mean? And so it makes our task very difficult because we have to say, yeah, the government is not telling you the whole story, but not in the way that you think. And that's a challenging sell, you know?
Yep. And they're happy to let the whole UFO phenomenon take control.
Yeah, it's good cover.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's great cover.
That's the margin in which they exist almost entirely, frankly.
Yeah. And also, like, yeah, there is a deep state. You know what I mean? Like, of course there is. There's a bureaucracy. There are people. There are career.
CIA, hello.
There are career people who, like, they work for the government from administration to administration. And the oversight of these entities is complicated and imperfect. But that's still different than we've been breaking the law for 50 years, right? I mean, it's like an order of magnitude different than what the UFO people are claiming. But it's not a clean narrative on our side either, because it's like, yeah, there is that kind of stuff going on. It's just not at the level that you're claiming.
Well, in a way, that makes it more of an important skeptical lesson that just because there's not a cleanliness of narrative, it still doesn't change the underlying nature state of the evidence and what you can support with the evidence, what you can believe. What bothers me slightly about the current phenomenon, and I actually got contacted through my
by an alien?
First contact.
We're not supposed to talk about that, Bob.
And, oh, sorry.
it was a survey intended toward academics, and it was seeming to probe attitudes of academics toward UAP research. And yes, it said UAP, not UFO. And I was like, okay, this is starting to send off my antenna a little bit, my little alien antenna, as to what's going on. And so I took the survey, and what it did is it presented me with a bunch of academic articles about UFOs and asked if this changed my opinion of the literature. And my answer was no. You're not going to hand me three studies and expect me to change my opinion on this overall phenomenon. And that, and I kind of might have left some flaming comments at the end of that survey. and after it was done, I was like, wait, why didn't I save what those articles were? So I went and found some of the articles, and some were published by the editor in chief of the journal that they were published in, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's just like, this is like your gold standard of evidence. Like, and it was like in a journal that had like nothing to do nominally with aerodynamics. It was like in a journal on entropy. And I was like, okay, how much is this being pushed into the academic sphere? And it's hard to tell. And so, but that's one thing that I would worry about is like, if now, like if enough academics get snookered, it becomes a little subfield. Now, I think like all of them, they'd probably eventually sort of deflate over time, like a flan in a cupboard. But that is one thing I thought was interesting. Then you mentioned NASA. I remember I saw a talk by the NASA administrator, current NASA administrator, and in the talk he was giving to kids, he was talking about one of the big reasons NASA should go out into the space is so that we can meet aliens out there instead of down here, where we're seeing all these alien contacts with wow. And it's the same talking point, Steve, where these airplanes are locking on with radar and getting a range and confirming we know these things are happening, and then they're going off at impossible speed, the same old. But I was like, wow, so this is high level, you know, again, these are administrator level people at NASA, not necessarily the rank and file scientists. But, you know, that's the thing I worry about, that basically it's going to be the next generation wow, there's really something to this UFO thing.
Yeah. Meanwhile, it's a giant nothing burger. I mean, literally, when you dig down, it's like,
there's not even any ketchup on it.
This is the same stories they've been shopping around for 30, 40 years. Sometimes literally the same ones. And the quality of evidence is abysmal. It's more blurry photos or dots of light or things that are indistinct.
Yeah. And the fact that we keep going back to it, the fact that with the proliferation of high quality cameras in everybody's hands, we're still not seeing those good videos and there's no reason why you wouldn't have four or five different videos of the same event from different perspectives, which definitely lead credence to it, right? If you saw five videos, each from a subtly different angle, like, whoa, that would take some work to fake.
And the thing about
I've never seen anything like it.
Right. As cameras and videos have become more common, we're seeing more blurry photos, but we're not seeing better quality data.
Right.
We're not seeing, oh my God, that's really something. That's not a plane. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're not seeing that. Well, the other thing is
they live in the blur.
It's when the evidence is the blur. The if you think about the government, you know, and that just one point that I think it's important to emphasize is, again, remember what they're alleging. They're alleging, like, they're covering up the biggest story in human history.
Yep.
Of all time,
grand conspiracy.
Yeah, without any even anything close, you know, to this story, and they've been doing it for decades, and it's an international conspiracy, and yet they've managed to keep any smoking gun from getting to the press. No way, it's just impossible. Think about the Vietnam War. How long was it before the Pentagon Papers were released, right? Like, information like that, where, like, no one's denying that they're real, right? No one denied that the Pentagon Papers were legitimate. They were verified. They were released to the freaking New York Times. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Why isn't there a Pentagon Papers of the UFO movement? And no, the MJ-12 documents are not real. Those have been completely debunked. You know what I mean? Like, there's the alien autopsy video, and that turns out to be crap. It always craps out.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you bring this up, Steve, because, like, and because you're talking about the extreme end of the massive conspiracy, like, all where you have the whole government in it. Like I remember in the past you've covered, like, actual academic studies people have done on the numerics of how likely conspiracy is to fall apart when it's so big. It's kind of funny. Like, on Survivor, I got to experience the extreme opposite of that. And for those who don't know the format of the show of Survivor, basically you vote each other off the island. So basically, if you're going to get voted off, there's a tiny conspiracy that's launched against you that you have to uncover in order for you to find out, oh, they're coming for me. I got to make sure it's not me, right? And it's only a handful of people. The conspiracy may last a few days or perhaps a few hours or even minutes. Like, literally, it was five people who got together in a conversation around camp when you weren't there and said, hey, let's vote out, vote out that person, right? And even there, like, there were times where, like, we're going to make sure that we don't hatch the plan few to hours too early, because what's going to happen? It's going to leak. Right. You know, it's like, it was interesting, you know, kind of from a skeptical perspective, to one, to have to try to ferret out real conspiracies on a short timeline. But it was also the other end of the spectrum of the massive, now to the tiny conspiracy which was highly plausible.
Absolutely. And there are conspiracies all the time. Yeah. Right? We don't deny that. People get confused. Like, you don't think there are conspiracies?
Of course.
No, we're talking about grand conspiracies. Yes. It's all about the size and the duration. Mm-hmm. How many people would have to be involved across how many institutions for how long? And because it just gets exponentially more difficult to maintain a conspiracy the larger and longer you have to maintain it. And again, the academics have showed this mathematically, that these things just implode at some point. There's just no way the biggest story in human history has been covered up for 50 years without one good photo getting out, especially now that everyone, you know, has access to digital information, where it's, you know, somebody would, like, the Snowden thing. Like, he's he blew up that conspiracy pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's no way that they would be able to keep this under wraps for this long.
And not to labor this issue for too long with you guys, but the one thing I noticed as a person who doesn't deal with this day in and day out like you all do, when I sort of checked in on this whole UAP thing, that's when I found Mick West. I know you know Mick West.
Oh, sure.
We interviewed him. Yeah,
he would take some of the famous recent videos, such as the gimbal UFO, and just break it down in such phenomenal detail to the point where it's just like, oh, what else could it be other than this? And you can't always do that, of course. Sometimes you're in that low information zone. You just have no information to know what it could be. But sometimes just seeing such a calm and academic breakdown of a thing without any sort of bombast is, at least to me, so convincing. Maybe not everybody, but to me who was catching up on this, I thought it was incredibly compelling.
Now, his videos are very compelling, and he basically deconstructs the narrative, right? Because he demonstrates, like, no, these pilots actually did get their angle of attack wrong. They got the geometry wrong, and he proves it. He really demonstrates how they got it wrong. So that the appeal to the expertise of the military pilots is flawed. Mm-hmm. They make the same kind of mistakes everybody make. They make errors of thinking, errors of perception, etc. All right, I did before we go to the live show, Christian, I did want to chat with you a little bit about robots. Again, we're going to be talking a little bit about them during the live show, but we didn't really talk about, like, the future of robotics. And I'm interested in what you think about that. Like, how quickly are we heading to like any kind of real game change in terms of robots in our lives? You know, like, is there anything that you think like, yeah, this is going to be the next big thing? In
the Roomba 2.
Yeah. A slightly better Roomba.
Yeah. I would accept a better Roomba 1 at this point. But as an academic in this space, I had the luxury of not having to hype up a product I'm selling. I can sort of look at the state of where robotics is right now. And I'm generally impressed with how the rapid progress of what people can do with robots in a particular setting. Such as you can get a drone to race really fast. You can get robots to actually run really fast now. But the question isn't about what can you get them to do one time for a camera. What can you get them to reliably do in our lives? And this is something that we see a bit in the AI, the current quote-unquote AI revolution, is that we are getting some of these tools that are really impressive what they can do sometimes. Autocorrect and voice recognition. You know, they've been working on this for a long time, and now they're really good. But I wouldn't trust my life on it, right? I wouldn't want this thing, you know, if it gets the word wrong, my life is over. Whereas if you have a robot that's, say, you know, up in your grill and it falls on you, that could really hurt you, right? You have to be really reliable if you want it to get up in your space. So, I mean, the classic example is you see the Boston Dynamics robots doing backflips and dancing on YouTube videos. They're incredible and they're real and they're amazing. Everyone respects what they do in the field, as far as I'm concerned. But even they would admit that, you know, they will show news organizations when news organizations come and interview them, they will show the robot going around and they'll show the robot falls down sometimes. They know it, and they're trying to improve it. So, and I think that I view robotics on a sliding scale of environmental control. You know, we know that robots are in factories right now. There are millions of robots in factories and quietly doing the job of making our stuff. And those are highly controlled environments. And I talk about this a lot. I might talk about this later. Who knows? But the reason they're so good is because they know what to expect that's coming at them. And when you step out of the factories, what is sort of the next step of sort of uncontrolled but still kind of controlled environment? And to me, that's the road. The car, you know, that's cars on the road. There are rules to the road, but there's also unexpected things that happen. So we have this whole autonomous car push, and we are pushing forward. But I think that I think a lot of people at this point are asking, "Hey, where's my self-driving car? Where is it?" There are some cities where you can have them, where you can have them pick you up in a cab, but there are some questions as to how much oversight there is by a human pilot, and that's not always known. But I think there's a little bit of coming to reality as to where we are with these systems. And those are sort of, let's say, semi-controlled environment, because there are rules to the road. You know, what rules are there to your home? I know you talk about this in your book. I know you talk about this. It's ironic. I find it funny that I came to a similar conclusion. But there is so little control for a robot in your home. So the companies that want to do home robotics, like a robot that will make cook for you, or maybe a robot that might help grandpa off the couch, they know these are not products that are going to be ready soon. They will start, but what they are doing is they're starting research institutes to answer those basic scientific questions of how do you fold the laundry? What are the algorithms to fold the laundry? And dealing with these categories of objects that robots have to deal with that they don't have to do as much in factories. You know, soft cloth folding, that's an active field of research. How would you, if you're cooking a vegetable, how would you know how to slice the carrot? What the carrot's a different size? And there are institutes that try to come up with control policies to handle that. But we all know it's still at the basic to applied research stage. So that's a long way of saying, Steve, that I think we have to wait a bit for robots to be in our homes. I would not expect it. In fact, if I were an audience member, I would apply your skepticism to whenever you see a product, something that seems like a product that's going to be in your home that's a robot. Anytime soon. If you see an advertisement or you see a cool YouTube video and say, oh, the robots are coming, you got to ask yourself, how often does it work? And just to belabor this a little bit longer, there's a great example. There's a company that I have ties to. It's called Agility Robotics. They make humanoid robots, and they want humanoid robots to go in factories. So if you're asking where they're going to show up next, there are multiple companies popping up seemingly almost every day that for some reason there's an intended market for humanoid robots in factories. Now, you could have knocked me over with a feather when I heard that, but it seems like people are really investing a lot of money because they want to put robots with a human form factor to do human form factor tasks. So that way you are in a factory where things are semi-controlled, but you're not bolted to the wall or you don't have to roll along the floor. People have done live demos, and where a humanoid would go and pick up a box and go put down a box somewhere else, basically sort of like doing this box stacking task. And they did it at live in front of a major industry conference. And this is a great test for how close we are. And they had multiple robots running around. It was a very impressive demo, but occasionally the robot would just fail. Sometimes the robot would just collapse out of nowhere. It would just onto the floor. And people will clip this and put this on YouTube, and they would say, and people say, hey, look, the robot worked for 5 minutes and gave up on life as a metaphor for humanity, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. But when they tallied it all up, it was like 99% reliable, which that sounds good. I would take that as an academic, 99%, but
yeah. I'm not 99% reliable.
I bet those, Bob, if you had to pick up hundreds of boxes a day, you know, my guess would be one out of 100 of those, you wouldn't collapse on the floor and die. And so there's still some ways to go. And I think everyone to my eye, I think the people I talk to in the industry believe that too, but they're banking that they can sort of close that gap. So where are robots going to be? I think first they got to be doing more things in factories. Then we got to start seeing more reliable cars. And if we start seeing more reliable autonomous cars, then I think we can start thinking about where are we going to see these at other places in our lives.
Christian, what about the, you know, the big advancements that we're having in artificial intelligence, right? So these robots are largely controlled by collections of algorithms, right?
Correct.
So you know, I'm just following the trendy news here for a second, right? So we're hearing lots of stuff about, you know, like ChatGPT and Bard and all of these, you know, companies are investing billions of dollars into artificial intelligence. If we have an artificial intelligence breakthrough, would that have a direct impact on how quickly developing, you know, robotics, you know, would you find at some point, wow, like all of a sudden the software is working way better than we thought it was working a few years ago because of these recent advancements. Would that have an impact on how fast things move?
That's a great question, Jay. And I think it's one of the questions I think to have the answer to and my answer is it could. It depends on the nature of the breakthrough. And these things like large language models, people are trying to incorporate them into how robots do tasks. Like there are researchers who want to take a task such as, you know, chop the carrot, use a large language model to develop the steps along the way that would chop the carrot and have the robot try to do those steps to break it down to digestible tasks. Also, another example is stable diffusion. And for those who don't know, that's the underlying technology behind those image generation AI software, where you create a picture of a cat Pokemon on the moon doing the hokey pokey or something, right? People are also using those methods to take different examples of robot tasks and stitching together the robot doing a somewhat different task. Like for instance, if you wanted to spread Nutella of different viscosities, you could have a couple of example. It's very. I actually have a friend who's working on this exact problem: spreading Nutella on bread. And using the stable diffusion to take a couple of different examples of robot motions, just like, you know, something like DALL-E might take examples of images to generate, instead of a new image, a new policy, a new task that it can do. And so people are doing these things, but and they are helping. But the question is, what would be the next big thing that you would need to now say, aha, this is, we now have the algorithm to put robots in our spaces and be much more reliable and more versatile and get things done without having to have an expert engineer program every single motion. That's not sustainable. And What you'd be looking for is some really good jump in the generality of what a robot can do based upon a reasonable set of data. You're also looking for something that's going to give you more confidence in safety. And often that isn't in the field of AI traditionally. It's in the field of controls. Controls is an old field. It's it's hundreds of years old. You know, it's a mathematical field. But one thing that people like about controls is that given certain assumptions about your system, you know, say what you will about assumptions, but given certain assumptions, you can make some guarantees about performance. So there are some people who are really trying to mix sort of like the peanut butter and jelly of AI and controls to blend those together to have the, let's say, virtuosity of AI to do cool new things with sort of the performance or stability guarantees that you get out of control.
Christian, so you're talking about like what spaces the robots are going to be going into, and I agree it's going to be factory, then semi-controlled spaces, and the home is going to be like the last space it's going to get into. But there's also the question of especially when you're talking about the home, the robot, because robots are already in the home. It's really more of a question of how general purpose versus narrow purpose are they going to be? Because I'm pretty happy with my Roomba. I think it does it exactly what I want it to do. It does it impressively well. I have a higher end one than you have. I agree. I think the crappy ones are crappy, and if you get a high end one though, I'm quite impressed with it and does it's fine.
Decades of engineering that went into that.
I think it'll be a very long time before we have an all purpose humanoid robot in the home. But I think more Roomba like things might be in the nearer future.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like, and just like you go from, let's say, controlled environments to more uncontrolled environments, you go from specific tasks to more general tasks. So imagine, and this is just me coming up with, a random pitch here, but a Roomba that maybe had a little arm on it that maybe could pick up some things and help move them around. Imagine you had a Roomba, instead of just sweeping up the floor, you'd pick up the kids' toys or something along the way. Or maybe put them in the box, put them in the toy box. That'd be a niche product, but maybe it's something that where the company start thinking it into something getting a little bit more general, but it'll be incremental, I would say. I say that, but, I also say to any funding agencies listening, I would say by the end of the next funding cycle, I think we have this problem cracked where it's fully, fully general. But that is the dream. And that's the kind of thing people like me are motivated by, is that we know that with one humanoid, presence like ourselves, we can do a lot of stuff. Does that mean it's the best way to do things? Of course not. But we know that this kind of generality is possible. And is that generality always what you want? I mean, no, not necessarily. I don't need my car to be a plane and a spaceship. My car is a fine car. But there are times where it's nice to have some generalized equipment. The fact that our computers, think about all the things our computers can do. I mean, they went from word processor and maybe email sender and maybe paint, MS Paint thing to just anything. You could do so much on a computer these days, and that versatility really shines. Yeah. So I think we see that, like, wait, what if there was a machine you could have in your home that you're like, I need to fix the roof. Can you go fix the roof, please? And it could just do it, right? That would be awesome. Like, there are so many little things, and it's like, my shower, like the knob of my shower got broken. Yeah. I wish I didn't have a handyman to do that. The robot can do that,
That would be awesome.
Wow. As a somewhat recent homeowner, I now understand the value of a handyman and not just calling the landlord. There is value because there's so many tasks that need to be done for us to live. So many of them I just do not want to do. And so that's one of the potentials, I think, of a generalized robotics. And that would be exciting. Exactly the avenue, which way to go, it's hard to know. If I knew that, I'd be probably a lot richer. But I think that moving, just finding the low hanging fruit and moving forward from that, I think that's a good way to go. Just kind of generalize piece by piece.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, the question of specific task versus generalized capability is an interesting one, because I think it's different for a lot of different things. I generally tend to prefer that I have something that does one thing really well. But sometimes the versatility is worth that. I remember when smartphones first came out, and I'm talking pre-iPhone, like the first real smartphones. And I was very resistant to them. It's like, you know what? I just want a good phone.
What was
I don't need to do anything else with this.
iPhone.
BlackBerry.
Well, I think there were, like the BlackBerry. Sure. I never owned a BlackBerry. Like, I don't need to like do email and texting on my phone. I just want a good damn phone. And they were a bit clunky as a phone. I wasn't willing to sacrifice the phone app to get versatility. But then when the iPhone came out and that generation of smartphones came out, the versatility was so off the hook, it became worth it, you know? It was like, okay, the camera is not as good as my camera, but it's in my phone. But I have it with me at all times.
Catch a UFO if it happens to appear.
Exactly. So, it's interesting, the trade-off, and there are thresholds. So maybe the same thing will happen with robotics, that we have a bunch of specific task robots until somebody could make the iPhone of robots, basically where it's so versatile and good enough at so many different things. That becomes worth it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And particularly what the example with the phone on a camera is perfect. It's perfectly apt, because if you had asked me in the year 2000, hey, Christian, do you want a camera on your phone? I'm like, what are you duct taping to my phone? Like, why would you and cameras were much more, people didn't run around with cameras all the time. You know, they were more like, if you were, you were like a hobbyist or a tourist. And also, what are you going to do with a camera? You're going to go develop the film in the middle of the day? What's going on? But it ended up being this ubiquitous thing we now all have. We all take for granted we have a camera, even though it didn't seem obvious at the time that, of course, we'd want a camera at all times. Think of all the things you could do. Also, because we didn't have high bandwidth internet or social media to share things at the time. So the point being is, it could be unexpected the avenues in which these things finally crack wide open. I think that level of humility of knowing what it's going to be and the creativity to think of what it could be is important when we're trying to project the future on this.
Oh, absolutely. Hugely important. Mm-hmm. It's underappreciated. And, you know, you just can't anticipate, you know, that texting will basically supplant using the phone.
Not for me.
Who really saw that coming?
Yeah, for sure. And I'll say that in terms of robotics, one other angle we haven't really talked about is that, like, we can get these robots to do a lot, but they're still kind of expensive. I mean, that's the elf in the room. They're still pretty darned expensive. I mean, a humanoid robot, like sort of an Osimo, that's sort of Honda's robot, which you could never buy, but there were competitors such as Hubo, and similar ones that are like these sort of like, they look like little spacemen walking around. They're made by Japanese and Korean companies. And it would cost half to a full $1 million to buy one of those things, probably 10 years ago, thereabout. I mean, and now you can get one for about $100,000. So that's order of magnitude. That's coming down, but it's still very expensive.
Need a couple more.
Yeah, it's going to be the last. Probably
need
the
to
last.
Get down to the prosumer
level. I mean, it still runs on a lithium-ion battery, right?
Absolutely does. I mean, Elon Musk wants to have his Tesla bots, because he unveiled his Tesla bot in the last year, and he wants it to be down at $20,000, like the cost of a car. And it's like, it's one of those things that I'm like, I'll believe that when I can buy one for my laboratory, because that's just right now there's a long way to go to make things cheaper. We're getting better at this, and in a number of ways, like we're finding that we can get away with cheaper sensors. We can find ways to make actuators cheaper. We can be smarter with how we use them, so that way it can drive down the cost. But it's still a ways to go.
All right. Well, you know, if there's any big robot breakthrough, we'll get you back on.
Thank
and talk
you.
About
Appreciate it.
Christian, thank you for being so generous with your time. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. And we're going to transition now to our live show from DragonCon. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our live recording at DragonCon to talk about one of our sponsors this week, HelloFresh.
A busy fall schedule doesn't always leave you with time to spare. And with HelloFresh, you don't need to spend all evening in the kitchen to whip up a wholesome meal. With their quick and easy recipes and 15-minute meals, you can get a tasty dinner on the table in less time than it takes to get takeout or delivery.
So I've made about 10 of their meals at this point, and I have been pleased every single time. you know, absolutely fresh produce. The quality of the meat is fantastic. The recipes are very easy to follow. And again, they give you everything portioned, so you don't have to do any measuring, which is really nice. And on top of that, it tastes really good. I really do enjoy it. It's easy. And from what I'm reading, it is actually less expensive than if you went out and bought the ingredients individually at the supermarket. So it is a really good thing to do.
So go to HelloFresh.com/50Skeptics and use code 50Skeptics for 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months. That's HelloFresh.com/50Skeptics and the code is 50Skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, September 3rd, 2023, and we are live from DragonCon. Yeah. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody. Thank you.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Atlanta.
And we have a special guest this week, survivor Christian Hubicki.
Yeah.
Christian, welcome to the SGU. Now, I understand you're a longtime listener of the show.
I am. I have a vintage T-shirt on and everything from the first Nexus in 2009 in New York City.
Wow.
So,
whoa.
It's pretty close to OG.
Damn.
Yeah. I'm a longtime fan.
So you sort of cross a lot of lines with us. Oh, you're a skeptic. You're a fan of the SGU. You're a proper nerd, as we like to say.
Indeed.
You're an actual scientist. Does robotics.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of a celebrity because of the Survivor thing.
I forget what letter of the alphabet celebrity I'd be. Probably in the M to P range. But yeah, absolutely. I'll take it. No, it's been a lot of fun. Like I said, my background's in robotics, and I'm now a professor, and I run a research lab. So that's my day job. And at night, they throw me on islands. So what could I want?
Yeah, this is. I got this photo off of the. I think it was the Survivor Wiki. You look pretty fierce.
Yeah.
Pretty fierce. You were in the David and the David versus Goliath group.
That's right. Our season was themed after David versus Goliath, and I guess the idea of that some people were big, strong favorites and us weakling underdogs. Naturally, I'm a big, strong favorite. No, that's not fair. So for some reason, they threw me on the David tribe, but that was a lot of fun because I got to talk about algorithms on television, which I'm not sure they do much on Survivor normally, but in my case, they made an exception, which I appreciated of them.
And that actually made it to air.
That's the other thing.
This is the other photo I pulled. This is like your famous. You had to stand on this pole. How long did you last on this pole?
5.5 hours.
5.5 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. It was a good time. To be honest,
can't even sleep 5.5 hours.
Well, I mean, they put you in like this pain position, like you're being crucified or something, and you're designed to go numb. And I'm just trying to find ways to pass the time and not think about the pain. The best thing I could do was try to recite my master's dissertation to the host of the show. And then he was the one in pain.
Yes.
And,
that was psychological warfare.
Yeah, you know. I wasn't trapped in there with him. He was trapped in there with me.
Nice.
But he learned a lot about robotic exoskeleton control in the process, so I consider it a win.
Win. That's a win. Yeah, that's and you won. You won that grueling
challenge.
Yes.
Yeah, that was good. That was a fun time, and I got to say all the things I wanted to say to the host of the show. And so I don't think there's when you're that level of celebrity like Jeff Probst, the host of the show, is most people can't keep them held captive for 1 hour, let alone five. So he got to hear my review of all the seasons. So I'm sure he really enjoyed that.
You had a captive audience.
Yeah, I'm not. You know, we're on speaking terms again, thankfully.
What was the most surprising aspect of your whole experience on Survivor?
I mean, one was how fun it was. It was, I mean, yes, starving was not, well, that part was not fun, but you don't honestly don't feel like you're starving after a while. It was the intellectual rigor of a game of deception and political intrigue that you're playing solid for a month. It's one of the most interesting things I've experienced in my life. Like, there were times where, like, you know, people were trying to mount a vote. For those who don't know, the game is not just don't starve. That's a component of it. It's also about voting out your colleagues. So, and well, no, not getting voted out. And, you know, in a game for $1 million, people get pretty competitive.
That was a pretty good experience for academia.
Yeah, you know, I'd say, you know, departmental meetings, have a different take to them, you know, yeah, as a result. But the, and so, like, that experience of trying to, like, weave, you know, figure out what does this person think the plan is, what do they think I think the plan is, what do they think that I think that they think is the plan. Like, that's and all while you're not eating, it's a lot, but it was an incredible amount of fun.
Let's talk about robotics really quick.
Sure.
We're going to be talking to you about an item in a bit, but just to give people a flavor of what you do for your day job. So when are the robots actually going to take over the world?
What time is it? So my background is in Leggett robotics. That's what I was trained in. That's what I did my doctorate in. So basically bipedal humanoid walking robots. You know, it's a fun time. Makes for a compelling Survivor audition video as well. Just a note to anyone who's interested. But I particularly focus on the control algorithms. How do we make them faster? How do we make them more agile? How do we make them better not falling down and more efficient as they move along? And there's a good bit of math and coding and programming in it, but a lot of fun experimentation along the way as you're basically pushing robots over and hope they don't remember the experience of doing that. So now I run a research lab down at the FAMU-FSU College of Engineering. It's a joint program between Florida A&M and Florida State University, and I run a lab there. My students do excellent work to making robots walk better. We have couple of human-sized robots in the lab, one that looks like an ostrich called Cassie. It's about 3.5 feet tall. The other one's a humanoid robot called Digit, which is about five and some odd feet tall. And we're trying to get it to do more stuff more autonomously because robots, you can make great YouTube videos of them doing cool stuff. And that YouTube video is very reliable. It runs every time, unless it's on my computer, right? And so whereas real-world robots, you know, if you're going to put them out with other folks, with other real people doing real jobs, you got to count on them. And that's a real long-term academic effort between academia and industry to make that happen. That's partly what I'm doing for my career.
Yeah, we were chatting about this. You think that one of the biggest public misconceptions is how reliable robots are. Because they see the video, like, oh, that robot does that every time. You ask it, does it backflip? It could do a backflip. But really, that's like the video, how many trials was that?
Right, and the short answer is, we don't even know how many trials there are.
Yes.
You have to really rigorously document that. And if you're a company, you're not interested in documenting your failures to the public. Although I will say, the companies that do, they've actually been quite open when they do interviews and say, hey, it doesn't do this every time. We have a lot of work yet to do. Yes, our Boston Dynamics videos look awesome, but there's a lot of work to do. They're honest about it. But we don't know how big is that gap. I honestly don't know because we don't have that kind of data, and that's something that we academics, given that we're in the publishing business, should be doing.
And the media wants to see the successes. They don't want to see the robot failing time after time.
It's funny the first once or twice, but it gets old after a while. So,
yeah.
But what's the difference between it does a backflip successfully, the next three times it does it, it fails? What's the difference? Is it how subtle? It must be a nuanced difference that it can't replicate.
Well, I mean, it could be. I mean, with a robot, so many things can go wrong. I mean, it could be the core algorithm that you're working with is just not robust enough yet to just tiny changes in how you started and moved. I mean, it's supposed to be. That's what all these people shoot for. And like companies like Boston Dynamics, they do excellent work. They're like the best at it. They're among the best. But it also could just be silly things like the hose in your robot hydraulic was loose that day, and that created a thing. Like
a little friction in the joint.
Friction in the joint is a major thing. Friction is very hard to come up with a good model of that we can rely on for robots, and that's a major problem. Other things that are hard to predict are going to act. Collisions. Two things hitting each other. And it could act one way, and almost you could have two situations that look almost identical, but they sort of bounce off into different directions. And legged robots are all about impacts. What are those feet doing to the ground? Impacting them, right? Over and over and over again, every step. And if your control algorithm is good, it should be able to handle that variation. But that's a long process, and it's difficult. And it's hard. So I really respect everyone in the field who's tackling it.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to power through some science news.
Science.
We're going to start with Bob.
Me?
Yep. Telling us about... This is a follow-on on our every now and then discussion of all that space junk that's up there in orbit. What are we going to do about it?
This was fascinating. Researchers have discovered a way to use batteries to help deorbit satellites. Like, well, how does that work? First, though, what's the status of satellites in low Earth orbit? Currently, the latest numbers I have, we've got 22,000 objects that are being actively tracked by an agency called the Space Surveillance Network. I don't know much about them, but they're tracking 22,000 objects. But they also estimate that there's over 900,000 pieces greater than a centimeter in orbit around the Earth. That's a huge 900,000. They're not doing anything. They're just like basically junk flying around at very, very fast velocities. And if you go less than a centimeter, it's in the millions. And remember, these are traveling at thousands of miles an hour. You do not want to be hit even by something really tiny. They're basically bullets. Yeah. So, well, what's the big deal? Low Earth orbit's really big, right? Well, it's big, but this is a lot of objects. And there's always the fear of something that we've mentioned on the show, the Kessler syndrome or this Kessler effect, which is basically that at some point you're going to have a cascade of collisions that eventually becomes a situation where there's so much debris in orbit that you can't do anything in orbit. No satellites, no people are going, no astronauts, nothing. It's basically a dead zone for decades or centuries. That's the big fear. And
interestingly, I was reading about that recently, yes, and we were talking about this, that you know, this is not, the Kessler cascade is not necessarily an event. It's just a mathematical probability that could play out over years or decades. In fact, it's possible it's happening right now. Like, we're at the beginning of this process.
It's not only possible, I will say. I will say right now that it has started.
Yeah.
And that's because I found this quote on the NASA site. NASA says, debris is now self-perpetuating in low Earth orbit due to the sheer number of objects.
That's what it is.
Worse than that, debris in low Earth orbit are now projected to increase even without the addition of any new objects. So that means that the objects that are deorbiting naturally is smaller compared to the collisions that are creating new pieces. So I would argue that the Kessler cascade has already started.
Already happened.
The question now is, how long, probably at this rate, it would probably take years and many decades to get really bad. But the process has already started, and that's like really a really scary thing.
How else can we screw the planet up, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the surface, the ocean, the atmosphere, and then now, of course, low Earth orbit.
This might actually be a good reason why we haven't been visited by aliens. They may come and be like, no fucking way we go in your head. That's a death trap!
Those humans are a hot mess. So how do we
track?
There's been a lot of plans to deal with these satellites and how to deorbit them. You put a thruster on satellites to deorbit them. You have tethers. All are expensive. A lot of money, a lot of time. This new idea is called LIBDO. LIBDO stands for Lithium Ion Battery Deorbiter. Now, how is that going to help deorbit? All satellites have batteries. And most of those batteries are lithium ion batteries. Now, when you think of lithium ion batteries, in terms of danger, what do you think about?
Fire,
right?
Explosion. Yeah.
Well, actually, so some genius realized, well, maybe we can take this dangerous aspect of lithium ion batteries and turn it to our advantage. So they actually realized that if you start this cascade leading to a thermal runaway on a lithium ion battery, it's actually a vacuum capable solid rocket motor. It could actually be used.
Of course,
used,
I was going to guess that, actually.
Right,
yeah,
yes. So they did a test. They said, all right, let's take this battery. Let's start a thermal runaway. They measured it, and it created like a force of 29 newtons, a vacuum equivalent force of 29 newtons, it's not a lot, but it might be enough.
It's enough.
It might actually be enough. And the great thing about this is that the batteries are already there. All you would need to do for all future satellites is to have a little nozzle. You add a little bit of a nozzle on by the battery, and you need to be able to control the altitude control of the satellite so that when the battery goes off, you could control the orientation of the satellite so that it deorbits. That's all you need. You're adding a minuscule amount of new weight. So when an astrophysicist or an engineer hears about, you don't really need to add any new weight to the satellite. They are very, very happy. Because when you say to them, you got to add 20 pounds, they're like, sorry, that's going to cost $1 million and it's going to take way too much time. So this is an amazing opportunity. And so here's an example of what you could achieve with this. If you've got a satellite that's 15 kilograms, it's in orbit, it takes 10 and a half years to deorbit. It's lifetime, it's deorbiting lifetime when all the work is done is 10 and a half years. If you use a battery like this, an optimized lithium ion battery, What you could do is you could do the explosion of the battery, the burn of the battery, and you could bring it from 500 kilometers to 400 kilometers. That would reduce its orbital decay time to, instead of 10 and a half years, 4.7 years, which is a 55% reduction. You're basically cutting the deorbit time in half, which means that it's half the time that a cascade can start, where something could hit it and it could break up into a million pieces. So you're decreasing that time. I mean, it's not quickly deorbiting, but if you're cutting the deorbit time by half, that's great. That's a great start, and it's cheap. It won't cost hardly anything. So this is a great idea. I hope they really run away with this.
Yeah, but this is only for new satellites going up. They can't do this to existing satellites.
Obviously.
Yeah. But that's a – so what are we going to do with existing satellites?
Yeah,
we're screwed.
What's the solution?
I mean, what are we going to do? It's going to cost money. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be time-consuming. But this is something at least that is – all new. It should be a lot. All new satellites should have this.
Absolutely. It should be the standard.
It's no panacea.
But just like global warming, which is obviously on track to kill us, like they wait too long and this gets more sloppy.
It gets harder.
Like, we need to do it now, right?
We need to do it 20 years ago. But now it's better than – later. So there are two companies that I'm aware of that are working on an alternate for satellites that are already up there. This is a really clunky way to do it, but they basically send like this crab thing up, another satellite to grab it and then deorbit it, right? So this will only work for big satellites, right? This is not for the little nuts and bolts that are zipping around in orbit. And it's going to be expensive and it's going to take time. But it's better than nothing. Like every satellite we pull out of orbit is one fewer thing that could participate. Interestingly, the satellite that they were targeting for a test flight in next year or in 2025 for this system, they were looking at it with a telescope. Like it's already been hit by something and has been broken up into multiple pieces.
Great.
They still think they'll be able to grab it because it's kind of clustered together. But instead of being a solid object, it's now a pile of rubble. So, ironically, it's already been hit by other debris.
And I see some of these things at the research proposal stage. So you're seeing the companies are ready to go right now. Yeah. What I see as a faculty member, like they're soliciting ideas, and the NASA will put out proposals for with very specific ideas of what to look for. And they were looking for things shortly after impact, like what you're talking about, Steve. And they as part of the call. For proposals, they showed this graphic of what it's like very shortly after a collision. And the idea was that that if there's certain kinds of collisions, they will spread out if you let it go long enough. So if you get intercepted early enough, everything will be still kind of in a cluster.
Right.
And I was looking, I was like, oh, is this something that's doable? And I was looking at it, I was like, after 5 minutes, they were already many miles apart. Uh-huh. I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, it's like basically you have to intercept this thing from some other side of the planet and get there seemingly in minutes. And I gave up on any possible ideas. Yeah. It's just such a horrendous problem. And I can't, so it's going to be a tricky one.
Because any momentum that you're adding or subtracting is going to put it into a slightly different orbit. Yeah. So it's going to just drift away and spread out.
And don't forget, this whole crab idea where it's going to grab it and deorbit it, that's okay, but you're not going to be able to grab something and deorbit it and then go somewhere else and deorbit that and then go somewhere else. It's way too expensive in terms of fuel.
Can't go to different orbits.
You can't.
It's like a one-shot deal.
One-shot deal. That's not a great solution.
On that cheery note.
Yeah. Well, this next news item will cheer you up, though. All right, so this is all theoretical, but it's
cool.
Super cool. Has anyone here heard of dark stars? Dark stars, they're dark because they're made of dark matter, not because they're not light. In fact, they're extremely bright, theoretically, if they exist. In 2007, an astronomer named Elizabeth Freese, F-R-E-E-S-E, I think that's Freese, she hypothesized that, hey, in the very early universe, when there was clumps of dark matter, there were local regions of dense dark matter, it's possible that hydrogen and helium, because most of the universe, especially at the beginning, was all hydrogen, a little bit of helium, as that coalesced near a pocket of dark matter, the dark matter would have coalesced with it. And even 0.1% of dark matter in the mix would be enough theoretically, to keep that hydrogen and helium into condensing into a star. And so it's possible, so we don't know what dark matter is. We're not 100% sure it exists. I think it probably does exist. So if it exists, but we don't know what it is, but if it is capable of annihilating itself, right, if two dark matter particles, if they collide with enough momentum, if that energy is enough for those particles to annihilate each other, then what will happen is those dark matter annihilations will release light and heat. And that heat would be enough to keep the hydrogen and helium from coalescing into a star, right? So you have basically a star fueled by dark matter annihilations rather than the fusion of hydrogen into helium and then into heavier elements. So what would this mean physically? Like, what would be the physics of a dark star made of dark matter? So they would be a lot, they would be capable of getting much more massive than a regular star, and they would be a lot bigger. So they could be as big as 10 AU in diameter. So that's 10 times the radius of the Earth.
Wow.
Right? The biggest ones.
Earth's orbit.
Yeah, the Earth's orbit around the Sun, 10 times bigger than that. That's
wow.
massive.
Wow.
And they could have millions of times more mass than our Sun, millions of solar masses, and billions of solar lumens, right? It's billions of times brighter than our Sun.
So anything around it would get cooked.
But it's cool. It's cool. It's not hot.
What do you mean? Like it looks cool?
It's relative. Yes, it looks cool, and it's temperature-wise cool, relative to a star.
I believe the surface temperature would be comparable to the Sun's.
Surface temperature of the Sun's not that hot.
Right.
But the core, there is no core temperature. There's no core.
Right, right.
Where fusion's happening.
So planets could be around it.
Well, this would be in the early universe before there was any heavier elements.
Rocky worlds.
Yeah, no, yeah. Okay. So no.
Nobody playing reruns of Rocky over and over and over again.
No. That's correct. These would be population 3 type stars, right? Which ironically is not the first stars. It's the ones that are only hydrogen and helium. This is her hypothesis. Maybe there are these dark matter stars that an individual star is as bright as a galaxy, right? Because it's billions of times as bright as our Sun. So it's bright as a galaxy, it's huge, it's massive, and it only existed in the very early universe. So if we're looking really far back in time, right, towards the first few hundred million years of the universe, maybe we could see some of these dark matter stars. So enter the James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, right?
Yeah.
Which can look at these very, very distant. And then what you're seeing in the picture here, by the way, this is a galaxy field. Those are galaxies that you're looking at, right? And these are ancient galaxies. So what Fries and colleagues did to follow up on her 2007 hypothesis was to pour through James Webb Space Telescope data and say, are there any of these ancient galaxies? So first they picked out objects that were extremely redshifted, right? Redshifted means they're far away, they're old, they're early universe. They took those, they said, all right, which of these have the spectra, right? Spectra are the bright and dark lines when you analyze the light from an object. You could tell so much about the universe by looking at spectra. It's amazing.
Fingerprint.
Yeah, it's a fingerprint of different, of all kinds of processes and elements and whatnot. So anyway, if you look at the spectra of these objects, they found 4 candidates that have the spectra that are consistent with the models of dark stars that she came up with in 2007. So basically, like these 4 things, and there were 3 of them in particular, these 3 should be considered dark star candidates. It doesn't mean they're dark stars. We don't know that they are. Now,
but Stephen, in my reading, it said that these stars, these candidate stars were very far away, which of course it would need to be. And secondly, they said it was more point-like and not fuzzy.
Well, no, it's just that they couldn't tell the difference. It's not that they were more point-like. If you're looking, the James Webb Space Telescope, because they are so far away, it's still just a point of light. They couldn't. So one way to tell the difference between a galaxy and a single object as bright as a galaxy is a galaxy would be fuzzy, and a single object would be more of a point of light. They just couldn't tell the difference. So if they could, then that would confirm that it was not a galaxy.
Well, we might need a better detection device.
Yeah.
Right?
So, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. But what is going to happen is we need a more detailed spectral analysis. So, because there are fingerprints of dark matter stars that we could absolutely see with a more higher resolution spectral analysis. So we, and James Webb Space Telescope can do that. The problem is it would take months of observation in order to get that higher resolution. And they don't have the time on the JWST.
Yeah, you have to dedicate the time.
Because everybody wants time on the JWST. And this is one experiment. Like, hey, could we have, you know, access to this for several months and, you know, basically block every other experiment that people want to do so that we could answer this one question? Now, you know, it would not, I don't know, you know, who makes these decisions or who gets time on the JWST, but let's say we were able to confirm that these were dark matter stars. How big a deal would that be? Like, is it worth time on the JWST?
It is. And, it's a Nobel Prize.
Well, it would be huge, and everyone acknowledges. They're saying, listen, you know, the data we have so far, there's other possible explanations for this. There are stars that have the same kind of spectra. Again, it's just consistent. You could make a model that's consistent with the spectra that we're seeing. So we really, they're not confirmed. But if they were, that would mean several things. One, it means dark matter 100% exists, right? I think right now it's like 99%. But there are people, you know, serious astronomers who have good arguments about, you know, the modified Newtonian dynamics.
And are they good? Are they really good?
I mean, you know, to listen to them say it, yes. But the majority of the opinion is no, there's dark matter. But this would end the debate. This is one of the ways in which the debate would just be over. If there are dark matter stars, there's dark matter. Right? So it would 100% end that debate. Two, it would tell us something very critical about dark matter. Dark matter is capable of annihilating itself. Not all models of what dark matter could be necessarily have that feature. So it would narrow the list of possible candidates for dark matter itself and would help us, you know where to look in the universe for dark matter and figure that out. The third thing is that it could be a possible explanation for supermassive black holes. So galaxies that formed early in the universe, most of them, like our galaxy, have a supermassive black hole at the beginning, at the middle of the center of the galaxy. And these are black holes that are millions to billions of solar masses. Again, they're massive. And, you know, astronomers aren't exactly sure how they formed in the early universe. Like, why did so many, you know, black holes coalesce into a supermassive black hole?
They're too big. They're too big to be explained by modern
theory. Yeah, so this would...
How did they get that big? We don't really know.
This could be one solution because, you think about it, you have a billion solar mass, no, I'm sorry, you have a million solar mass, it's a billion times as bright, a million times as massive. Million solar mass, dark matter star, and you have that 0.1% dark matter making light and heat and keeping it puffed up. When that dark matter runs out, all that hydrogen and helium collapses and forms a black hole because it's already too massive to hold itself up as a star. It just would immediately collapse into a black hole. That could be why we have a lot of supermassive black holes. So it would potentially solve that mystery as well. So there's a lot riding on this. I don't know what's going to happen going forward. Right now we just have these candidates. The whole idea is fascinating. It may be completely wrong, but that's how science works, right? You have to make these hypotheses and, more importantly, figure out ways to test them. And that's what, you know, Fries and her colleagues are doing. This is the possibility. It fits the models. This is how we can test it. Until you answer that last question, this is how we can test it, you're just, you know, just chatting in the breeze.
So what's the cool part?
Yeah. I'll play it back for you later.
Okay.
all right. Christian, yeah. So do you do this work with the drones? Or is this?
I do some drone work. I don't do this drone work.
Well, tell us about this drone work.
Oh yeah. So researchers at the University of Zurich at the robotic and perception group, as well as Intel Labs, have suddenly announced that they have an autonomous drone racing system which has achieved champion level performance. Like, they can beat human champions at racing through drone gates. People can see the image of the drone trails going through little squares, doing time trials with drone gates. And this is really cool. It was actually published in the journal Nature just on Wednesday. And to get a robotics finding in Nature, you know, to my understanding, robotics aren't natural, so it must be pretty good that they lower their standard. But the big finding, and this is for a number of reasons, but we'll get into that. So what do they have? So basically what they created was an autonomous system. They call it SWIFT. I don't know if it's an acronym for anything. If so, it's a very clever one. In order to make this drone racing controller work. And basically, there are two key components of what it needs to do. One, and this is often undervalued in robots, it needs to know where it is. And people forget that they need to know this. We take for granted that we know where we are in a room at a given time, and it's developed all kinds of cool algorithms, including the best acronym in all of robotics, the simultaneous localization and mapping called SLAM. I'm jealous of that. That's good.
Nice.
Of course, like slam it, right? You know. So part one is you have to know where it is. So it uses what we call a visual inertial odometry. And have we covered this on the show in the past or no?
Many times.
Okay. Well, I mean, we all know what odometry is. That's the odometer in your car, right? How do you know how far you've gone? It counts how many times the wheels have turned, right? Well, we don't have wheels with these drones, but you have vision. So you can do visual odometry. Basically see what we have a camera on board the drone, and you see how much the image flows past you, and that gives you an estimate of how far that you've gone. That's the visual part of the visual inertial odometry. The inertial part is also really cool. It has an inertial measurement unit on board, and that has two components in it. One is a gyroscope. We've heard of a gyroscope before, right? Detects rotation. You get a good enough one, you can detect the rotation of the Earth. You know, take that, flat earthers, right? Yeah. Take that, yeah. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. We had one of those in the lab and proved them wrong.
They proved themselves wrong with one of them.
That's amazing. Yeah, you remember that? That was that documentary behind the curve.
Yeah.
That's amazing stuff. It was the ether got in the way. That was the problem.
Damn
right?
Ether.
Right. So the one part is the gyroscope that senses rotation. The other part's the accelerometer. Now, who here has an accelerometer on them now? Anybody? Anybody?
Everybody, right?
Guess what? You probably do if you have a cell phone, right? So it's the thing that determines if you're in portrait or landscape mode, because it's determining the acceleration of gravity, you know, and you know, which way it is down. So it also senses all kinds of accelerations. Like if you ever were in a car and you fell asleep and you suddenly felt like the car come to a stop, like you've been parked, right? You felt that inertia. That's kind of what an accelerometer does. And you can, that's acceleration. You can integrate that up to position using calculus. Then you can know where you are. And you combine these two things together, the visual and inertial, you can get some pretty good estimates where you are. That's half of it. The other part is deep reinforcement learning, and I'm sure this has been covered many times on the podcast,
yes.
Right? That basically, once you know where you are, what do? And so what they did is they trained this drone in a computer simulation. They built a computer simulation of the drone, and they would try 100 different drone races at a time. And they would, and reinforcement learning, you give it what's called a reward signal. What's good and what's bad, right? And that's the art of reinforcement learning. Part of it is saying, hey, what's good and what's bad? And it has to be a pretty clearly defined task. And you might think, well, how fast do you finish the race? Well, sometimes that's a little too broad. You have to give it something more specific. So what they gave it was a reward was time between gate 1 and gate 2, time between gate 3 and gate 4, basically trying to make sure you get to the next gate as fast as possible. And when you get there, you're looking at the next gate, right? That's the way that they told it. Like, that's the reward. So, and they ran this thing, and I always ask people when they do deep reinforcement learning, how long does it take to run on the computer? It turns out less than an hour. Less than an hour they got this thing to actually learn a policy. Now, there were some tricky parts we can get to in a minute, maybe it's a little discussion about this, that because the simulations aren't perfect, and that can lead to real problems. When they put this all together, the headline was they had it race in time trials against champion drone racers, three like world champion level drone racers. One was like the Swiss champion, one was the world champion. I don't know if they're, I don't know how they take the rankings of this all. I'm not going to get involved in that world. And the autonomous Swiss system got the fastest overall time and was the most consistent of them. And when they broke down the actual performance of the drone, the thing that they found was that it was most consistent getting from gate to gate and made tighter turns. And overall, the consistency between gate to gate helped to get it faster overall time, whereas the drone racers themselves, the human racers, were able to get some faster segments, right? They were able to sort of speed up and slow down at different points in order to, like, it would beat them out sort of like in a partial time. But overall, the drone system was the fastest. And the claim here, according to them, is that the first time an autonomous robot achieved champion level performance in a real world competitive sport. I don't know what the chess people feel about that.
Yeah.
I wonder what they feel.
Or the Go people. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The Go people, right? But that's the headline. There's lots of nuance to it too. It's really interesting in how they achieved this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of obvious applications, right? We're talking about, like, we want to have as a travel option, you know, drones with people in them. Mm-hmm. And not hitting stuff is probably a good thing.
I'm in favor of not hitting stuff. We, this is the part in life we do in our own lab. We do drone avoidance. Like we'll have a drone and we'll like throw a pendulum at it at like 10 meters a second and we'll have to dodge it out of the way. You know, like that's the kind of thing we'll do. But one thing that's sort of underrated, the understated like robotics thing that I point out is that all of this computation and sensing was on board the drone. And that is hard to do because it's much easier to have a desktop computer off to the side. This is what we'll do in our lab a lot of the time when we're debugging stuff, right? And it, and so that it will do churn through all the calculations and tell the drone what to do. And also, a lot of labs will use motion capture systems to tell you where the drone is. That's easier than using SLAM. I just want to say SLAM again. They don't use SLAM. I just want to say it. And so they had onboard camera doing all the calculations. That all the calculations were done on board, and that's really impressive. Some caveats that in the paper that are different is that, you know, we talk about this inertial sense that the drone has. Well, people don't have that in the drone. The human pilots don't have an inertial sense. They don't feel the bank of the turn. So that's an advantage that the drone has structurally over the person. So there are sometimes structural advantages in these human robot performance games. It happens all the time. But they also pointed out that the camera refresh was only 30 frames per second. And I'm not a biologist. They said, though, that the human eye performance is more like 120 is what they were saying. So humans had an advantage there. So they kind of said there's a little bit of here, a little bit of there. But bottom line, this is really impressive with not only what they can do with the drone, but what they can shrink onto a tiny drone computer and camera because they can't carry very much.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'd think if they could do that, then what's up with autonomous cars?
When I saw this, I was thinking about this, Jay. It's actually a great question, Jay. There were no other drones on them. They're not like racing in and out with other drones. You don't have to worry about colliding.
Oh, okay.
With
their
that's
a time
easier.
That's a big one. Yeah, so that's a big one, right? So, you know,
imagine. No pedestrians.
Some of those videos, man, in autonomy. Yeah, those can be pretty scary. But yeah, there's nothing else on the course there. So, I mean, that's a next level thing maybe they want to do. But like, what this really shows is that you can get a big enough neural network with enough data, and it turns out a reasonable amount of data, to do all kinds of stuff. We found this, we see this in legged robotics all the time. The neural network approaches can do really awesome stuff. And then the question is, how reliable is it going to be? You know, thankfully it's a race, so you only have to count your best time.
Yeah.
You don't have to count your worst time.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So getting back to my question at the beginning of the show, pretty soon.
What time is it? Yeah, right. 5 p.m.
All right. Jay, we can't talk about everything to do with Mars, but tell us about, if we're going to settle Mars, how many people do we got to put there?
All right. Well, it's super complicated. Every study that's come out so far, you know, I think the consensus is, yeah, maybe. You know what I mean? Because we know right now there's so many things that are dangerous and new about doing something like settling Mars. You know, there's thousands and thousands of different technologies that need to be developed that don't exist today, and they're working on it. You know, but we need to figure out like every single thing that can go wrong before we start doing this. So there's two studies that I read about. I'm going to focus on one of them, but I'll give you a little bit of a comparison between the two. The first study is, and I'll tell you right out of the gate, they said 22 people. So think about that as we're going through this, which I think personally is way too low to have a sustained...
Self-sustaining settlement.
Not really self-sustaining. Even in this one, they were saying 22, they need some resources from Earth. Mm-hmm. But even still, it's a super low number. I don't see how it works. But they asked a few questions. Now, this is coming from the George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia. They wanted to know what conditions are needed to maintain a stable outpost on Mars. They wanted to know what combination of personality types would do best in this hostile environment. And then they wanted to know how many resources are needed for 2 years between resupplies and assuming occasional accidents. So they were saying that it takes about 2 years to get, you know, resupplied from Earth, which is a big deal, because if you need something and you tell them, hey, we need it, they're like, okay, well, in 2 years you'll have it. That's no bueno.
Can't they just, like, call Amazon and get it?
With the drone thing, you know, you never know.
Amazon will get that down to 2 months.
Be honest, yeah.
So I'm going to focus about their unique angle, which was they were factoring in personality types, which I have not seen in any of the other studies that are done. So they were saying at its core that people have to cooperate for there to be a successful ability to maintain a settlement. Now, that seems really obvious, but the scientists need to think about stuff like this because they're picking people that can handle stress and are really smart and are, you know, like, you know,
capable of doing different tasks and all that. But of course, you know, you don't want to put narcissists up there, you know, because they're going to have big problems. So they're taking that into account in this study that they did. So what they did was they created a computer model. They used several computer simulations to project out a 28-year span of people living on the planet, just to see like what would happen after the 28 years. So their approach that they had is they used something called agent-based modeling. And to really squelch it down, what it means in this case is that they are factoring in human interaction, along with all the other things. But this particular model includes human interaction. One thing that they said was that their model has to be pre-constructed before people arrived, which, again, that's a big deal, because if we're going to pre-construct it, then we have to have the technology to pre-construct it, which means robots, which is a big difference from the other study that I'll talk about in a minute. They also said that there has to be stores already in place of food, air, and water, which they said all need to be created in situ on Mars. That's another huge thing, right? Like, if you're going to say, yeah, we have to have food, water, and air already being created successfully to sustain, well, how are you going to do that? Where's all the technology, you know, which we don't have today in order to pull that off? Oh, another thing that they said was they're also saying that they would have constant power for 7 years, mm-hmm. which is nice, because solar panels don't work so great on Mars for lots of different reasons, so they would have to use a nuclear generator.
Yep.
So getting into basically the personality types. Now, I know most of you know, like, you know, studying people's personality types and taking tests, like, you know, all the different ones that are out there, that's all nonsense and everything. But they basically created four different groups. They said there's people who are agreeable, people who are sociable, people who are reactive, and people who are neurotic.
That's an accepted personality profile. That's the ocean, you know.
Yeah, and I agree. I read it.
So that's legit.
I read up on it. It is legit to say, okay, we have these four basic personality types. Of course, there's infinite shades of gray and all that, but let's put that aside for a second. So guess what personality type worked the best?
People who have been on Survivor?
Yes.
Survivor Mars, yeah.
So between agreeable, sociable, reactive, and neurotic, the agreeable people by far, when they tested it. So what they basically did was they started with tests that had an equal amount of each, and then they run through the simulation, and they said, well, what happened, what went wrong, who caused the problem, and then whichever way success leaned, they increased the number of those types of people, and they kept doing it and kept doing it, and then they basically said, everybody's got to be agreeable for this to work, so we can't have any narcissists running around on Mars. They said, just to give you a definition of what agreeable means to them, they said individuals with the lowest degree of competitiveness, low aggressiveness, and not fixated on stringent routine, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting, because those are features that might be beneficial, you know, trying to run the settlement on Mars.
So,
say neurotic, as if it's a bad thing, but you know, being a little neurotic, like worrying about things that can go wrong.
Yeah. Detail-oriented.
Obsessively checking stuff, you know?
I took it as flexibility. You might be doing something different today than you did yesterday.
Yeah, flexibility is good.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a ton of routine, you know, if you're going to be keeping the machines running up there.
Well, how about this? Tons of routine. Like, for like 8 months, you're doing the same thing. Holy shit, but today you got to do this.
You got to do something completely different.
You got to be okay with that, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that works.
I would think, intuitively, I would say balanced would be better.
Like I said, so over the many simulations they ran, they had a varying degree of results from 170 people, and they were able to get it down in their model to 22 people by using the people who were considered to be agreeable. So I'm going to quote them. They said, the research team said, this demonstrates that team and individual psychological success in extreme environments can be broadly attributed to coping capacity, which we define as the ability of people, organizations, and systems using available skills and resources to manage adverse conditions, risks, and disasters. This study is not peer-reviewed yet. Now, another study who took a very mathematical approach to the whole thing, and it wasn't just focused on Mars. They're basically saying, like, what would it take to settle basically anything that's a hostile environment? And they came up with 110 people. So, you know, the big question here is, why is there such a huge numbers difference? And again, the minutiae of the details of each study and what factors they took into account for and everything are the major swing. But I just ran out of the gate, you know, and I'm no expert. I know that. But 22 just does not seem
like it's enough to really pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, again, they sounds like they were looking at it mainly from the social perspective, but like it all depends on what you build into the model. Like, first of all, like how many surgeons do you want up there, right? And what if one of those surgeons dies? How many backups do you want, right? How, yeah. So how much redundancy you're building in is a completely separate factor than what they were considering. Or like they said, yes, the agreeable people will maybe help the society function better, but if you don't have the other personality types, does that have a negative thing to it they're not considering? Like, you're not going to have the person who's going to check the fail-safe or something, you know, obsessively, yeah. or whatever. So it's like an impossible-to-model thing. You're always just coming up with a construct and saying, well, if these are the factors that we take into consideration, this is the output. And that's an interesting thing to answer. I mean, that's interesting information, but it's not really simulating what would happen on Mars.
Yeah, and I think the real world studies, you know that there are real yeah. people right now who are living in a Mars simulation
yes.
environment.
Yeah, but there's what, six people? Was it four, six, something like that?
Yeah, it's very but still, cute. I mean, I think the data coming out of there is probably going to be much, much more accurate and useful than something
That's why
like
you got to do that. So, and I think that we would need to actually do a much bigger simulation. You know, yeah. Put people in a self-contained environment for a year and see what happens.
I mean, all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yeah, right.
That's what it comes down to. I mean, yeah. and there are things you can do in a model you can't do in an experiment. You have to target the experiment mm-hmm. appropriately, so that way you're validating the right thing or finding the new variables that you need. I mean, it is complicated, but I mean, I kind of love these age-based models. Yeah. I always view them like the Sims anyway.
Yeah,
like,
right.
That's what it's like. So it's pretty fun. So
it would be a fun sim game, like Settlement Mars. You know, and you get to decide all these variables, and it affects what happens.
Well, one thing I thought about after reading all this was, you know, like the dynamic between people. Like, if you happen to like another person that's there and you want to get into a relationship, you know, you're still living your life. Yeah, no, you're working and you're on Mars, but you know, you still want to have relationships and stuff. And if there's any kind of, like, there isn't a lot of options, you know, it's not yeah. like, oh, this person doesn't like me and then there's nobody else, you know.
Well, do you send up pre-existing stable couples? Like, that's a big decision.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Well, my takeaway, though, is I don't care about all this people stuff. My takeaway is like, wait, we got to send all these robots to Mars to prep it for us? I mean, how long is that going to take before we can even be anywhere near that level of sophistication?
I mean, again, what time is it? No, but they have to be more adaptable on the fly, yeah. is what it's going to come down to.
But my takeaway is that we are all going to be dead before any humans are on Mars. This is like, we're not going to see this. This is way too complicated. I'm so disappointed and depressed.
Oh my God.
Nobody.
Many
experts are saying, like, within 30 years, we will have boots on the ground.
That's different than a self-sustaining settlement thing.
Oh, yeah.
We will be dead. Yeah, not all people.
Elon Musk.
No, everyone in this room. Yeah, most of us will be dead.
Let me blow your mind. Elon Musk actually said that by 2050, which is, you know, roughly 25 years from now, there'll be 1 million people living on Mars.
God.
I mean, like, you got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding. Send me $300,000 because of how stupid that is.
All right. Evan, what is Meghan Markle wearing on her wrist there?
I want to know how many people know who Meghan Markle is. Raise your hand. Go ahead. Yeah, it's a lot. It's about 70% of the audience. 30% of you, very good. I'm very proud of you. And if anyone cosplaying Meghan Markle here today, I got no one. Okay, well, if you are, you see anyone out there, their cosplay is likely incomplete because located on her left wrist is a little circular sticker. Okay, you have to have that if you're cosplaying Meghan Markle. Specifically, that is called a NUCALM. That's NUCALM. NUCALM Biosignal Processing Disc, also known as an anti-stress patch. So this was first picked up in an article recently by Vogue.com, and the media jumped all over it after that. So what exactly is a biosignal processing disc? How does it work? Well, time for some science, right? According to its inventor, Dr. Blake Holloway, the patch blends neuroscience, Steve, pay attention, neuroscience and biochemistry to help regulate patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, right?
They mentioned an actual disease by name.
That's it. Yeah, according to the inventor, the disc enhances frequencies that relax the wearer.
Frequencies.
Yep. Right from the website, let me read this. This is hard science, folks. Pay attention. Traditional Chinese medicine...
Stop right there.
Just stop. That is from the website.
Must be true.
TCM explains that qi flows through the body along particular pathways or meridians to maintain health. Everything in the world as we know it vibrates with a particular pattern. Science. Thus, living systems produce electromagnetic frequencies androgynously that differ depending on the level of health or disease. Direct from their website, by the way.
Wait, what was that word you used?
They said
androgynously?
I'm sorry, typo here. And endogenously.
Oh, endogenously. All right, good. Because I was like, they are going into areas now that I can't even comprehend.
It is hypothesized that if you restore the frequencies that travel through the meridians, you can reinstate optimal physiology. These NuCom discs hold the EM frequency patterns of GABA, G-A-B-A, Steve?
GABA is a neurotransmitter. Yeah. Inhibitory neurotransmitter.
And its precursors to deliver a pure biological signal to your body. When placed on the inside of your left wrist, Meghan Markle, at your pericardium 6 acupuncture point, the disc sends a signal to the pericardium of your heart to activate local parasympathetic nerve fibers, which then transmit the signal to your brain, telling it to increase vagal nerve output and begin the process of slowing down the body. The disc stops your acute stress response, so the brain wave and entrainment with NuCom is always reliable and efficient in getting you into theta brainwave range, where restoration and relaxation can take place.
Evan,
that's like the trifecta of pseudoscience.
Yeah, officially the biggest load of bullshit I've officially ever heard in my life. That sentence. What did we just hear?
We're on DragonCon TV.
I need to take a goddamn bleach shower after hearing that,
right? I mean, you have to have some kind of advanced degree in order to be able to have the talent to coalesce so much junk into one gobbledygook paragraph
So did they mention disease at the beginning of this? Is that what you said?
He mentioned PTSD. You're not supposed to, like, name specific.
I was going to say, because that would take it out of the realm of structure function claim, right?
Yeah, right.
Under a regulatory...
Like saying relieve stress or promotes well-being, whatever, you, at least in the U.S., you can get away with that.
Right.
But once you say treats a disease, that's a no-no.
Okay.
Right. Are they misinterpreting? I mean, that sticker, I mean, to me it looks like she's got like an active Wi-Fi signal. Maybe that's all that...
Did you find out how much it is?
You have to buy them in packs of 20, $80 for a pack of 20, $4.
Yeah, for little stickers. And
how do you know when it runs out?
It lasts up to 4 hours per sticker. Okay. Of course, because you got to be putting these things
on. The frequencies wear out.
But you can recharge them, right? You can recharge them up.
But you can buy packs.
You hold a crystal next to them and it charges them up.
I imagine you walk into the place for the people that do it, and you walk in and they're just always laughing. Yeah, we're just like, holy shit, we're making money. These people are in.
All right, we do have to move on.
Okay.
We have just enough time for science fiction.
Having too much fun.
No, we don't.
All right.
6 minutes?
It's time for science or fiction.
All right, we're going to do a science or fiction. Yep, this is always a fun element. So I'm gonna have three items here, and then we'll poll the audience really quick. Then we'll poll the panel, and then we'll see if they changed their minds. There's a theme this week, and yes, I did choose this theme after I knew Christian was going to be on the panel. The theme is robotics. So it's kind of a high risk, high reward thing for you.
Yeah, I don't have tenure yet, so
you have
a leg up,
but if you get it wrong. Yeah. Okay, here we go.
We have 5 minutes.
I know. Here we go. All right. So according to the International Federation of Robotics, in 2023, there were 35 million industrial robots and 43 million service robots worldwide. All right, number two, the first robot-assisted surgery was in Vancouver in 1984, the Arthrobot, which assisted in arthroscopic procedures. And item number three, arguably the oldest robots include water-powered, clock-driven figurines dating from 3000 BC, and a steam-powered pigeon that could actually fly dating from 400 BC. So we're going to do the single clap method. If you look at me, I'm going to drop my hand when I get here, clap, if you think that the first item about the number of robots in the world is the fiction, clap. If you think that the Earth robot is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the flying pigeon is the fiction, clap. All right, so three is a clear winner in the audience. Evan, we're going to start with you. Give us your choice.
Guests always go first, Steve.
No.
Not today.
Not today. All right. Well, yeah. So, I, you know, the pigeon one, that's the most ridiculous of the three. It's probably science because of that. And the first one about the number of bots, sure, who knows, unless you have that fact at your hand. The arthrobot, though, the arthrobot? Is that what it says?
Arthrobot.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it made that name up. Sounds kind of too obvious in a way. I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, the pigeon one, like, when you say it actually fly, like, flapping wings, gaining altitude, or just, like, you know, like, well, shot up.
You throw anything
steam
off of a cliff, it flies.
So I think I'm going to say that one is science because I know my brother. to hurry up, I'm going to go with Evan. I think that absolutely we did not have a robot-assisted surgery in the 80s.
All right, Bob?
I'm going to have – imagining a steam-powered pigeon that could fly in 400 BC. Sure, it seems obvious, but I think that's what he wants us to think. I'll say that one's fiction. It's just like, no.
You do a double negative there?
Yeah, maybe triple, but
okay.
Whatever.
All right, Christian? Wow.
Okay, so number one, which is the number of robots in the service being tens of millions, that sounds about right from my knowledge of industry, but
yes.
I look forward to being wrong and being fired. number two, we're talking about surgery-assisted robots. I mean, the first fully robotic surgery is much more recent with the Da Vinci robots, but assisted surgery, that's more plausible, and that could be, and the problem here is the definition should be flexible. And that's where I remember that could be kind of tricky. So I'm somewhat suspicious of the surgery. And the clock-driven figurines, I mean, there are lots of things that are considered robots that are driven by mechanical processes, being pendulums, things like buoyancy, that go back to things like ancient Greece, and they could be theoretically called robots. So wouldn't it be crazy? And the steam power, we've got to think about different kinds of steam engines. We're not talking James Watt steam engine, if that were going in that. So I'm going to go for the robot surgery. Maybe is there something slightly off about that? Okay.
All right, so three out of four went for the surgery here, and Bob went for you went for the bird, right?
I did.
All right. So let's see if they change your minds really quick. If you think the number of robots is the fiction, clap. Wow, nobody. If you think that the Earth robot is the fiction, clap. Yeah, yeah. Definitely influenced the audience there. And if you think that the flying pigeon is the fiction, clap. So more evenly split between two and three. So
yeah.
We'll start with the first one, which there seems to be a pretty broad consensus here. According to the International Federation of Robotics, in 2023, there were 35 million industrial robots and 43 million service robots worldwide. And that one is the fiction.
No!
Holy shit!
Swept us.
Good job, man.
It's an order of magnitude less.
Is it 100? Is it 300 million?
It's 3.5 million. We're at 4.3 million.
Really? It's fewer.
Surprisingly low. I was shocked at how low it was. I'm like, I'm going to use that as a fiction. I'm going to bump it up by an order of magnitude. It'll be totally plausible.
Are you including Japan in this?
Absolutely.
Right.
I know. I was surprised at how low the number is. Wow. I mean, it's increasing pretty significantly. So industrial robots, you know, like the factory robots. Service robots are mostly Roombas, right? That's what they are. But it's anything and you can divide that into commercial and residential, but they're not, they're service robots.
Yeah,
anyway.
Service is not a big component. Yeah. That's not the thing.
All right. Number two, the first robot-assisted surgery in Vancouver in 1984, the Arthrobot, which assisted in arthroscopic procedures. That is science, and that was that exists for many years. That Arthrobot did many, many procedures, and this is also kind of at the dawn of the arthroscopic surgery, where you make a hole and you put the little cameras in there and do the surgery. So robots are kind of perfect for that. But yes, the Da Vinci and more sophisticated, more full robotic surgery systems came later. Technology always goes back farther than you think it does. Whenever you think the first of whatever was, it always goes back farther than you think. Then three, arguably the oldest robots include water-powered, clock-driven figurines dating from 3000 BC, that was in Egypt, and a steam-powered pigeon that could actually fly dating from 400 BC. That's science. I said arguably because, yes, it depends on your definition of robot, but yeah, there was you know, water clocks that had the, you know, the little guys would come out and hit the bell. Like, that's, you know, it's moving. It's a mechanical robot. And then the pigeon that could fly. So this guy was a genius. This is Arcus, I think his name was. He, here it is. So Jay, you're right. This is what it, this is what it is. You have a little metal ball with water in it. You were right about your description of what you thought it was pretty much exactly what
it is. Oh my God.
You have a ball, like a metal ball, you put water in there. The pigeon is a wooden, no moving parts, but like a wooden little airplane. You hook it to the end, you heat up the water, it fills with steam. The pigeon is hollow, so that fills with steam. And then at some point, the pressure is greater than the friction holding the bird onto the ball.
Right.
And it flies off, and it flies for like 300, 400 meters, they said. Wow. It was pretty
impressive.
It's like
a bottle rocket.
Yeah. So I was right.
It's like a bottle rocket, yeah.
I was right, because what I had in mind was not that, and what I had in mind didn't happen. So I was kind of right.
If that makes you feel better, Bob.
If that makes you feel better. That makes you feel better.
All I heard.
All right. But the bottom line is, I pretty much fooled everybody. No, they did.
I my unemployment. Yeah.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Individual science fiction stories may seem as trivial as ever to the blinder critics and philosophers of today, but the core of science fiction, its essence, has become crucial to our salvation if we are to be saved at all. Isaac Asimov.
Excellent. Nice. Well, Christian, thank you so much for joining
me
here.
Thank you.
Glad we're finally able to get you on the show.
Thank you so much.
And thank you guys for joining me, as always. Thank you so much to the Skeptic Track for hosting us. We're always happy to be here. And thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.